In early 2021, I shared a disturbing example of environmental pollution, otherwise safe pipes becoming toxic when heated by wildfires. These are plastic pipes that were just fine until they were widely heated by big fires. I can't help but wonder, I wrote, how many of these poisons in our environment undermine our health in ways that contribute to chronic pain. Well, today I'm finally answering that question as well as I can. It's been more of a learning cliff than curve, and I'm hitting the big red publish button like it's going to set off a bomb. I really don't know if I'm satisfied with how I've handled this topic, but it's time to suck it up and hand it over to you to decide. This is Paul Ingram of PainScience.com, and this is the PainSci Updates podcast, a casual members-only podcast featuring audio versions of posts from the blog with some improvised digressions, although not too many of those today because I've been through such an intensive writing process with this post that I think I've already thought of and integrated all of the digressions that I might otherwise have included. So today I'm reading the post Inflamed Planet: Do Chemicals Explain Some Pain? Published finally on August 19th, much later than originally intended. It's a huge post, but it's also just an excerpt from even more extensive new content that I've recently added to my full guide to low-grade inflammation and inflammaging. Previous versions of this content were already accessible to members, but it's changed so much in the last couple of weeks, and especially the last few days, that it's effectively brand new. Last summer, I added food additives to the guide, but it was really basic, just a list of possibilities. This summer, I returned to really beef it up and gave the same treatment to pollutants. I added a bunch more about allergies and particularly added mammalian meat allergy, which is a really interesting example that got its own blog post last week or the week before. And then I got lost for a while in the surgical mesh debate, and I updated that section too. And then there was a wave of miscellaneous improvements and edits throughout the whole article. Several hours of work, but it still wasn't done. I returned to add more examples and to start checking assumptions and sources, which is always kind of an interesting step, right? Like, there's a certain amount of you just got to go with your best estimate of something while you're writing, when you're in the flow. But then later on, the job of a responsible science journalist is to go back and check those and make sure that you weren't winging it a little too freely. And well, damn. When I did that, I discovered several limitations and errors, more than I would have expected. So I climbed that learning curve for several more hours and added a bunch of citations. And seemingly on and on forever. I feel like I've been working on this post forever. And of course, it's not done now. So, what should still be added? What have I strangely overlooked? I look forward to smacking my forehead as your suggestions roll in. Okay, let's get into the post. After a couple of decades of immersion in pain and injury science, I feel more confident all the time that some kind of biological issue is the culprit in most stubborn and puzzling cases. If we had magic diagnostic scanners like Star Trek's flashing beeping gadgets that just have to be waved over the body, I think we'd usually get a physiological explanation. Probably not just one answer, more likely a cocktail of contributing factors, but a distinct answer in the flesh. I'm on a long-term mission now. 5 years doesn't seem like enough to understand and describe all of those possible answers. And this post is devoted to one category of them: things in the world that we are exposed to, substances that we breathe or eat that might ignite a brush fire of low-grade systemic inflammation, a rising tide of physiological stress that lifts all the injury and pain boats. Inflammaging, which is a real and charming term, is the escalation of systemic inflammation with age. It is provoked by many things, probably including some environmental pollutants, maybe some food additives, and even a few foods. I'm extremely wary of demonizing toxins or chemicals because our fears about them are so aggressively fanned by quacks selling bogus detox solutions. I'm so wary of it that I put this topic off for years. But I can put it off no longer. I am more skeptical of the detox cures than the toxins themselves, at least Some of them are truly dangerous. You know, think about lead poisoning. The question is whether any of them matter for chronic pain patients. Wouldn't it be nice if you could get a realistic and science-informed threat assessment from someone who isn't trying to sell you the cure? Yep, well, it's your lucky day. I've only sold you the education. And fingers crossed, reasonable, science-informed speculation. So a little bit more about the detox quackery. I would be interested in detoxing if I thought it were possible. At least three times in the last few years, I have endured several days of thick smoke in Vancouver. Days of unhealthy or very unhealthy and sometimes even hazardous smoke. Air quality index scores from 150 to 350 that spell unavoidable physiological stress, even at the low end. Some prevention is possible with air filters, but treatment, detoxing, what I've inhaled, if only. Unfortunately, we mostly just can't detox much of anything beyond what our organs already do for us, which is quite a bit, but in spite of how good our organs are at detoxing, humans can still easily be poisoned. There are only a handful of specific medical treatments for some kinds of poisons, like antivenoms or chelation therapy. The massive detox industry is almost pure bullshit, along with basically all popular beliefs about detoxing. For instance, we can't sweat out toxins or suck them out of our bodies with Epsom salts baths. I just found a typo after about 8 proofreads, still finding them. But like every good scam, detox quackery is based on a seed of truth, and this particular seed is unusually robust and sad. Our world is badly polluted. It's an uncontrolled experiment on a brain-breaking scale. And our food system, not exactly pristine either. Trans fats alone are probably worse than several other candidates put together. I would kind of think of trans fats as a pollutant of our food system. Oh, and just a quick aside, in case you're having a pedantic moment. Yes, I know that toxins only refers to poisons produced by organisms. That's a biological poison. But toxins is used informally these days to refer to, you know, basically anything poisonous that we encounter in the environment. But yes, technically, toxin is just a poison produced by a critter. The major environmental pollutants. This is the first major subtopic here, pollutants. Pollutants in the air, water, and food supply are probably what most people hope to purge when they do a detox. People who talk about detoxing are almost never specific about what toxins exactly they're talking about. If they knew enough, what should they be talking about? There are 4 main candidates from the last few decades. There's the persistent organic pollutants. Also, a subcategory of that, an important subcategory, is the forever chemicals, which is the per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. There's the heavy metals, which is dominated by lead. And there's traffic-related air pollution. And, of course, other kinds of air pollution more generally. But air pollution is so completely dominated by traffic. Related air pollution is really, that's the only part of it that matters. Although I guess with the smoke thing, smoke is becoming more and more of a source of pollution for more and more people. Okay, so that's the quick list. Now let's go back and talk about each of those a little bit more. The persistent organic pollutants first, the POPs. This is pesticides, flame retardants, and polychlorinated biphenyls, the notorious PCBs, now banned, but formerly ubiquitous in many a plastic piece of crap. This category includes well-known dangerous chemicals like DDT and dioxins, along with dozens of more obscure examples. There is a broad scientific consensus that these are hazardous substances, but the practical public risk varies greatly with the details. It really depends. And I should clarify here that an important basic idea about poisons is that the distinction between hazard and risk. Hazard's the harm that a substance would cause if you took a shower in it. How inherently nasty is it? Well, risk is the chance that you'll ever actually be exposed to enough of it to get hurt. Another way to put it, it's the difference between how dangerous something is in theory versus practice. Hazard versus risk. Theory versus practice. But even though the risk varies big time with the details of, you know, which specific chemical we're talking about, there are a lot of them with, I think, collectively substantial risk. The forever chemicals, the per- and polyfluoral alkyl substances, or PFAs, all combine fluorine with carbon hydrogen molecules, which is the alkyls. They started with Teflon and have since ballooned into an immense family of, and I am not joking here, several million distinct chemicals. That's incredible. There are a lot of ways to combine fluorine with alkyls, apparently near infinite, effectively infinite from the human perspective. So this is a disturbing pop subcategory, a disturbing subcategory of the persistent organic pollutants that is still defined by scientific uncertainty. We know they're there. Like, that's not the question. We know they're out there. The scientific uncertainty is whether or not they have important health effects. And only about 10% of PFAs have been studied for health effects as of 2024. And most of those, not enough. In most cases, we know little or nothing about the hazard and even less about the risk. But we certainly know that they're all around us, not going anywhere, and some widespread harm from that is quite plausible. Heavy metals, lead. Lead is a useful element that happens to absolutely mess with animal physiology. It is known for being harmful at literally any dose, no matter how small. It might seem like this quaint old-timey thing that we don't have to worry about much anymore, but nope. Unfortunately, lead is still an alarmingly common pollutant, doing plenty of harm. It accounts for very roughly half of the known damage from all tracked chemical hazards. This hazard and risk, the hazards and risk of lead pollution, are as real and serious as a heart attack. And in fact, and this really pushed me over the edge when I first started writing about lead. I thought, am I really going to talk about lead? Is it relevant? But when I found this, I thought, oh yeah, yep, it's relevant. Because I didn't know this until I was digging in. Weirdly, heart disease is one of the main effects of lead, and the mechanism is basically inflammatory. I had previously thought that lead really only affected the nervous system, that it was neurodegenerative and in general character, and that's true. But it also, one way or another, gets us inflamed generally, and our body does not like that, and heart disease is the near inevitable outcome. So much more relevant than I realized at first to the topic of inflammaging. Low-grade lead poisoning almost certainly accounts for, you know, some small but predictable percentage of the world's inflammaging. Acute lead poisoning, of course, is relatively rare, but it is fair to guess that long-term exposure to small accumulating doses of lead is a significant health headwind that makes a small but relentless contribution to inflammaging in probably most of us, and probably more in an unlucky minority. Traffic-related air pollution, and especially diesel exhaust, with its sub-100 nanometer ultrafine particles, is a well-documented health hazard that we nevertheless probably continue to underestimate. And a good example of underestimating, this comes from some researchers local to me at the University of Victoria and the University of British Columbia. Just breathing diesel exhaust immediately alters brain function. That's their result. That's what they found. That's disturbing because you're not supposed to be able to inhale diesel exhaust and immediately affect your brain because that would challenge an old assumption that the brain is likely safe from direct pollution damage thanks to the blood-brain barrier. The authors reckon that the ultrafine particles are either getting in, quote, via the olfactory bulb and or secondary transmission of inflammation, circumventing the barrier. So yeah, you got particles tiny enough, they may just flow through nerves. And that's been demonstrated by some fairly persuasive animal evidence. Let's take a little good news detour, a little ray of light on this dark topic. We can reduce the risks of air pollution significantly. We have the technology. Cleaning indoor air is one of the best bang for buck options that we have for protecting ourselves from air pollutants. I have lovely, smart Corsi Rosenthal boxes powered by computer fans. This is a very efficient do-it-yourself air filter design, which can move a lot of air surprisingly quickly. And with air quality, clean air delivery rate is all that matters. There's a photo of my Corsi Rosenthal boxes in the post. It looks like a box fan. And in fact, you can make a box fan version that's just like just a box fan with a couple of filters stuck on either side of it. And those work surprisingly well, but they're very noisy. They work great, but they're loud. The PC fan solution, basically you just get a rectangle that's the same shape as a box fan, but instead of the fan being a big fan in the center, you got several little fans, PC computer fans, personal computer fans, mounted along the edges. I think mine have five fans mounted in holes around the edges, and they suck air into the box through the filters and blow filtered air out into the room. And they do this amazingly quietly, and they're not super cheap to build the parts and the components. They add up, but they're not terribly expensive either, and they work really, really well. Unfortunately, the air cleaning industry is really choked with bullshit and misleading claims, and many products are just junk, including some of the expensive ones. So you need a trusted guide on this topic. I strongly recommend the It's Airborne blog by Joey Fox, which does a superb job of filtering out the nonsense. You should start with his list of favorite air cleaners, which includes the PC fan-based Corsi Rosenthal boxes, but also some other options. Highly recommended, because as you've seen, there are some hazards in our atmosphere, and this is something we can actually do about it. So that's nice. Okay, let's talk about microplastics and nanoplastics now, too. Tiny plastic garbage has been much in the news lately. Dust-sized particles, microscopic ones, and now we know that there are even nanoscale particles, just like diesel's ultra-fine grit. The health effects of this kind of pollution have not yet been studied well enough to know how great the danger is. But there's plentiful plant and animal evidence so far, and plenty of cause for concern. The surprisingly recent confirmation of ultrafine particles probably increases the exposure and the hazard, and therefore the risk. An important and interesting clue that microplastics could be a problem is the extreme example of surgical meshes implanted in your body. Now, the effect of that is not settled science, but it is definitely possible that some surgical meshes are breaking down and causing illness, making people quite sick. Relatively low-grade exposures to the skin, lungs, and gut surely are not as dangerous as a higher dosage right in our flesh, but I doubt that they're entirely safe either. This topic I did a bunch more on, and there's more in the full inflammation guide. By the way, nanoplastics are already found in most of our fruits and vegetables, and not just in them, but like literally right in their cells. This kind of pollution is happening to everyone, everywhere, forever, and it's still accelerating, and it's probably cumulative. So even if it's not a problem in the early 2020s or the mid-2020s, I guess we're in the mid-2020s now, the 2030s may be a different story. In the post, I have an image of microplastics in a liver cell. A microscopic image of a liver cell, mostly on a black background, but that background is speckled with tiny green dots and then a whole bunch more of them inside the cell. Kind of a haunting image. Let's move on to food additives and other things that we aren't good at digesting. Talking about food additives risks fanning the flames of detox quackery and chemical paranoia even more than talking about pollutants. But there is another robust seed of truth here too. We have not come unscathed through over a century of industrialization and intense commercialization of the food system. There are some prominent historical examples of it going wrong, and there will probably be more in the future. And for every relatively obvious example, there's probably several subtle ones that will never be confirmed. Some of the things that we put in our mouths that cause systemic inflammation will probably do so through the intermediary of irritable bowel syndrome. Our guts are important, so bowel stress and dysfunction leads to more widespread problems. Most of those are probably nonspecific responses to relatively mild irritants. They don't have to be individually dangerous to be of concern collectively, and this is partly why we have so much scientific uncertainty about these things, because all of the attention and research goes to more sensational dangers. Trans fats are the best example of what puts the junk in junk food. Partially hydrogenated oils powerfully boost cardiovascular disease risk, because they exacerbate metabolic syndrome with systemic inflammation. There are many paths to metabolic syndrome, but eating piles of trans fats is taking a highway to heart disease. Although banned in a steadily growing list of countries, they are still widely used around the world, and even where banned, they remain in small quantities that can still add up, especially in extremely tempting snack foods. And junk food is still chunky for other reasons, of course. Next up is an odd one. This is an old food additive, manufactured citric acid. It's rather boring and old school. It has been around for over a century in many different foods. Sodas, juices, powdered beverages, candies, frozen foods, a few dairy products, and most canned produce. When's the last time you ate a can of peas? It's probably been about 20 years for me. I don't eat a lot of canned produce, but there's still a lot of it on the grocery store shelves. I think probably quite a few people still eat that. And here's a weird one. You can find it in cheap ice. If you buy ice, I don't know, it's used as a preservative? I don't know why it's in ice, but apparently it is. So this has been around for so long that it was already old when the US FDA got going, and they just gave it a pass, and its safety has never really been studied properly. And yet, there are specific biological reasons to suspect that it could be mildly toxic to some people. So we've got this, you know, maybe a problem food additive that's been around forever that has never been checked. I think we should probably check it. Non-celiac gluten sensitivity is a tricky topic, which is a hilarious understatement. But one way or another, it is probably an example of struggling to tolerate something that we eat, if only we knew exactly what and how. The major candidates are gluten, FODMAPs, and the amylase trypsin inhibitors, the ATIs. Everybody's heard of gluten. Quite a few people have heard of FODMAPs in the last few years. They've gotten a reputation for being the real troublemaker in wheat rather than gluten. But that's not clear. And we do know that FODMAPs do not cause an inflammatory reaction. That makes them an intolerance, not a sensitivity. And then the ATIs are very unfamiliar to most people. Gluten and the ATIs do trigger the immune system, causing inflammation in some people. All three of these things probably interact in complex ways for different reasons, different people at different times. So the practical takeaway from this mess, even though we don't know the details, it is reasonable to be concerned that some people do in fact have an allergy-like systemic inflammation triggered by something in wheat. The problem is probably being grossly overstated by many people, but I do think it's real. I used to roll my eyes at wheat fear, but I stopped when I learned more. Speaking of intolerances, let's talk about milk now. A classic example of one of those things that some of us just aren't very good at digesting. Good old lactose intolerance, which is notoriously undiagnosed, is one of the things that can chip away at us sneakily. Lactose intolerance is not an immune system reaction, although there are also dairy allergies that do cause that. But it is now clear that lactose can cause a range of debilitating systemic symptoms, in addition to the well-known gut symptoms. At least 50% of people with lactose intolerance report muscle and joint pain. So this is an example of what I said earlier, that the mechanism of irritating the whole system may be just messing with gut function. And lactose intolerance really is just being poisoned by undigested lactose in our gut. It's just irritating to the gut to have a bunch of undigested lactose in there, and it osmotically sucks a lot of fluid into the gut, and it makes you very gassy and prone to diarrhea. And yet there's no systemic inflammation, or at least not directly, but that constant gut trouble interferes with gut health overall, and that does apparently have systemic effects. Another weird example, Olestra or Olean, those are brand names that anyone over the age of 30 might remember. This is an artificial fat, sucrose polyester, that infamously causes one of the most cringe-inducing symptoms of them all. Anal leakage. But that's just the tip of the iceberg of the intestinal outrage. It's likely that these have systemic health effects through the intermediary of IBS, just like the lactose intolerance. And this stuff is still around in related forms. The sucrose esters are mostly dead as the basis for branded fat replacement products. Nobody wants to buy anything that says Olestra on it. But they're still widely used as a food additive in smaller and less obvious ways. So, a food additive notorious for causing anal leakage is, in fact, still in our food supply. Fun facts. I was not pleased when I learned that fun fact. Artificial sweeteners. These are perpetually controversial. Their safety endlessly ambiguous, and this is a vast subtopic that I'm not going to try to cover in a bullet point any more than any of the others. These are all bullet points for things you could write books about. Despite all of the research and the media attention on artificial sweeteners, though, much of that attention has focused on carcinogenicity, and the remainder has been about metabolic health, like whether or not artificial sugars make us insulin resistant, whether or not it has the same hormonal effects as sugar. And a lot of all of that is probably overheated. The carcinogen risk is for sure overstated. And the metabolic health issues probably also exaggerated. But what about the effects on gut health, which might actually drive inflammation? Just scientific crickets on that point. A 2016 review declared that we know essentially nothing. And yet, as with manufactured citric acid, there are perfectly good where there's smoke, there's fire reasons for doing the research. Quoting from a paper in 2016, Spencer et al., the two main areas on which there is data to suggest that artificial sweeteners affect the GI tract include motility and the gut microbiome. So that's what we should be looking at. And yet, we've looked at everything. But that if there's a safety issue with artificial sweeteners, it's probably the effect on gut health, not that it's a carcinogen and not that it is having the same metabolic effects as sugar. And that's the end of the post, which has come up on me very suddenly, and I'm puzzled to discover as I'm reading this aloud, there is no conclusion. It's just the end of the list. Yep, okay, that's the food stuff. We're all done now. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.